We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
The Bernstein and McKnight Show.
Pleasantries being exchanged between Mike Krzyzewski and Leonard Hamilton. And congratulations to the Duke Blue Devils, the ACC tournament champions, for the 21st time.
It's March. Duke is always about March and the postseason. What is the mentality once you guys hit the postseason?
Kill us, go.
Middays on the Score.
That's one way to phrase it, I guess. Time to take a look at this NCAA tournament while it is fresh and clean in our hand, an unblemished sheet of paper, and just all of these vertical and horizontal lines representing our next few weeks of sports enjoyment. Sam Vecini of The Athletic is on Twitter at Sam_Vecini, host of the Game Theory podcast, joining us in the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, home of F-150s, for just $229 per month. Sam, hello.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good. What's top of mind for you as you look at the stories of this bracket?
I mean, it's got to be Duke, I think. Duke has, in my opinion, the two best players in the country, at least, in Zion Williamson and R.J. Barrett. They have another guy in Cam Reddish that is going to be a top 10 pick, at the very least, in the NBA draft, we'll say. I think he probably goes higher than that, but we'll be conservative. And they have another first-round pick, probably, in Trey Jones, too. So you're talking about a team with four first-round pick freshmen that has very clearly, in my opinion, when they've been healthy and when they've had Zion, been the number one team in college basketball this season, get the number one overall seed, get a few kind of interesting matchups in their region, at least, and just kind of get set up for a really, really fun NCAA tournament here.
So as we look around for the players in this tournament, they're going to make themselves known to the NBA watchers of us in just a little while here. I wonder if you think this coming draft is a little bit different when it comes to the NCAA tournament because of the distribution of talent. It's Zion, then a golf, and then a couple others. And you can make the argument as to who's where and what. But I remember reading something around your Twitter timeline. I think around the time Zion had been out for a handful of games, Cam Reddish had been playing pretty well. Is there more to be made for some of these picks 3 through 15 in this tournament than otherwise because of who's sitting at the top of this prospective draft?
Yeah, I would say that there is. Basically, starting from number 4, all the way down, like, through the first round, realistically, this thing is kind of wide open right now. There are two guys that are in certain tiers, right? Like I said at the top here, Cam Reddish is probably not going to fall out of the top 10. I don't think DeAndre Hunter should fall out of the top 10. But you talk to executives, for instance, about Keldon Johnson at Kentucky. Some executives think Keldon Johnson, they like his competitiveness. They think he's an improved athlete. He's an improved shooter. They think that he could become a really solid starter at some point in the NBA. Other executives see him as like a bench player that is like a number 25 overall pick, something in the mold of Josh Hart with the Lakers right now. Kobe White is a guy that is wildly kind of everywhere on teams' boards. You know, I think he's like a top 12 draft pick in this thing. He's 6'5", he's a point guard, he can really shoot pull-ups. Other executives, again, see him as like an end-of-the-first-round guy. Nasir Little, maybe the most polarizing, divisive prospect because he was an elite-level high school player that ended up just not being very good this year at North Carolina. If he can have a big NCAA tournament, he would really solidify himself in the top 10, I think. If he has a bad NCAA tournament, you know, I don't know where the floor is on his stock. So I think that there are really large storylines here to be still told in regard to the NBA draft.
I always call it the Tyrus Thomas effect for the recency bias toward a great tournament. And no matter what scouts say, Sam, no matter what they say about the body of work, no matter what they say about going back and looking at tape, they are swayed by what they've seen most recently. And it must just be human nature that sometimes overcomes there. Do you think there's anybody who can play their way from out of the draft or second round up to first round? Because there sometimes a guy just goes absolutely bananas, and people say, wait, I didn't think this before, and now I think this.
Yeah, let me just say at the top here, I totally agree with you. It's part of the reason that, you know, guys who have big NCAA tournaments, like Tyler Lydon, for instance, at Syracuse, end up going in the first round, and, you know, why executives end up looking at these workouts that end up being 1-on-0 or, you know, 2-on-0 if they're agency workouts, and, you know, evaluate them very strangely in the context of how this entire process goes. I mean, like you said, theoretically, there is a full body of work, and I think that the teams that evaluate based off the full body of work end up being most successful, but you're right, this stuff happens. And the guy that I'm kind of looking at that I think is going to really potentially rise up, I really like Cam Johnson at North Carolina, 6'9", 47% from three. His stroke is just perfect. Like, he can shoot it on the move. He doesn't necessarily have to have his feet set immediately. He can just turn his body in the air and knock down shots from distance. That guy, it just seems like a no-brainer fit in today's NBA as a role player. You know, most executives see him as like a second-round guy right now. I think he probably ends up going in the first. You know, I'm trying to think of some other guys. Like, Naz Reid at LSU is interesting. He's been very inconsistent this year, but the flashes that he's shown have been, you know, extremely high level. He's a 6'10" center who can knock down threes at like a 38% clip, but can also like really handle the ball and attack closeouts. He's really smart. He has a great IQ for passing the ball and finding teammates. So I look at him as someone, you know, he leads LSU to the Elite Eight or something. He could easily end up rising up draft boards pretty easily. I mean, in terms of some other guys, Chuma Okeke at Auburn is a player that a lot of NBA executives like as a second rounder that I think could rise up into the first round. It's kind of a weird year, though, because a lot of these kids that are in this draft process and a lot of the guys that NBA executives have spent the last month or so trying to find, you know, they're just not ready yet on this stage, I think. There's a big difference between guys that are like seniors, low upside guys that will probably play a role in the NBA but probably not a starter, and then these guys who aren't finished products should probably return to school in all honesty. And, you know, maybe we'll just end up declaring because this draft throughout the, you know, bottom half of the first round is pretty weak. So it's going to be really interesting to, I think, watch that kind of juxtaposition of just talent in this NBA draft.
We're taking the tournament into the draft. Sam Vecenie of The Athletic. You can follow him on Twitter at Sam_Vecenie. Sam, I'm thinking back to Murray State against Austin Peay in February. It's a 2-point game. I'm watching Ja Morant, and he's, you know, making cuts down the lane and dropping passes off to his big guys, and then dribbling it off their foot. Murray State ends up winning by 2, but he didn't get a whole lot of help down the stretch. What happens to Ja Morant if the 12 can't pull off the 5 against Marquette, if instead we're not watching 2.5 weeks of the kid and he's out in the first round?
Yeah, I still think he goes in the top 5, basically regardless of what happens with Murray State here. Like, I don't think he probably – like, he won't surpass Zion Williamson barring injury for Zion at number 1. But somewhere in the 2 through 5 range, there are enough teams up there that need point guards. For instance, Chicago. Phoenix is another team that could really use a point guard. I think that there are enough teams that are going to be in that mix that he's not going to fall out of the top 5, even if they lose. And, you know, to be honest, like, you know, someone that does like gamble on college basketball, I was kind of anticipating fading Murray State in the first round, but they ended up matched up with Marquette, and that Marquette team is so hit or miss that I was kind of bummed. I thought that Murray State would be like this very public team that got a huge rallying, you know, cry from the public. But I think that Marquette just isn't quite good enough for them to take advantage of that difference in what I think the line should be.
I'm looking at some matchups early on that might be intriguing. And just you know, off the top of my head, as I see possible Gonzaga-Syracuse, I always find teams against Syracuse interesting because of some days against a 2-3 zone that's that well coached, you just don't have it. I love watching Nevada play. And Nevada, if Nevada-Michigan in the second round, that could be an absolutely gangbusters game. Do you agree?
Yeah, I agree. I think the West region as a whole is the strongest region. You look at Gonzaga, you look at Texas Tech, Michigan, Florida State. To be honest, I think all 4 of those teams are top 10 teams in college basketball.
Wow.
And then you throw in these, you know, weird bracket busters like Marquette. I just said that, like, I think they're pretty inconsistent. But if Marcus Howard's going to go for 40 on any given night, like, they're a dangerous team on any singular night. Nevada, like you said, is a senior-laden team that's very talented. Jordan Caroline, the Martin twins. You know, you look at Murray State. They have Ja Morant. They're going to be dangerous every time they take the floor. Vermont is a really good team. Like, Florida State, I think, is just going to overwhelm them athletically at the end of the day. But Vermont, you know, I was coming into the tournament anticipating that, thinking that they would be kind of dangerous in this thing. So, you know, overall, I look at the West region in general, and I'm very excited. And we didn't even, you know, mention Buffalo here. Buffalo is a really fun team to watch. They really, really push the pace in games. They have a senior-laden team with C.J. Massenburg and Jeremy Harris and Nick Perkins. All three of those guys are pros somewhere. I think Massenburg and Harris legitimately might play in the NBA.
Is that a relative of Tony Massenburg? You know?
I don't know.
I wonder. I'd like to check that. I haven't heard that name in a while. Longtime NBAer.
But yeah, I think that, like, you look at this West region, it's going to be the most fun. I mean, being out here in LA, the regional is in Anaheim. I'm very excited that we kind of got loaded up with teams out here.
What's the evaluation then of Rui Hachimura with Gonzaga? I think that team's always an interesting one for folks because it's so far out west. They are a one seed. They have deserved it. And the recruiting, they've gone under the last couple of years has been a very interesting process.
Yeah, so with Rui, I mean, I'll throw Brandon Clark in here too. You know, scouts are kind of mixed on which one they like more. Scouts that tend to evaluate defensively or at a high level really like Brandon Clark. He's maybe the best defensive player in the entire country, along with Washington's Matisse Thybulle. Rui, in his case, right now he's not a very good defender, just doesn't have the reaction skills that you look for on that end. He kind of will close out heavy and get stuck in the mud and then get blown by. But he has the length, he has the quickness to be good. He's just not there yet. Offensively, he's really improved the jump shot this season. He's not quite where it needs to be. Like, he's only taken 32 threes this year in 33 games. That's just not enough for what his role will be in the NBA. And it's kind of led to him being a divisive prospect because on one hand, you can see the jump shot never totally coming along and him end up being like resigned to being something of a small ball five that just kind of kills matchups athletically off the bench, right? Or if you think the jump shot is going to come along, you know, he is 6'8", 240 pounds realistically, 7'2" wingspan, can really handle the ball, has a kind of an elite level combination of speed and strength. I don't think people realize how strong he is when he's attacking the basket. And I think that if he gets the jump shot down, there is real potential that he could be a high-level starter. It's just going to take the right development situation because, obviously, you know, he is still adjusting to the cultural norms, cultural everything of America. He's been here for 3 years. He's good here. He's happy here. And, you know, I think he's done a great job getting into American culture. But it's still going to take some time. I think the team that drafts him is going to have to really create a plan to make him successful.
Why is Kentucky's Keldon Johnson a better prospect than his actual on-court production might otherwise indicate?
Yeah, I think that NBA teams look at Keldon kind of, like I said earlier, as a guy who fits as a perfect role player in today's NBA because he's very competitive defensively. He really just wants to win. That kid is a winner, full stop. At lower levels, he showed some passing ability that he hasn't really shown this season, which, you know, how much of it is Kentucky's scheme holding him back a little bit in that regard?
Yeah, that's what I want. That was going to be my next question is where scouts are looking at certain players in certain programs under certain coaches and say, I know I'm not going to see this from him here, so I'm going to have to project
right.
it.
Right. No, that happens every year. You know, I think that Carl Anthony Towns is the best example of that, right? Like, he might be the best 7-foot shooting big man, like, in history, maybe, other than Dirk Nowitzki. And, you know, he shot 2 threes probably at Kentucky the whole year. So that's definitely something that has to be considered. And then on the other end of that spectrum, you know, I think that scouts are starting to consider more and more coaches that put their players into great positions offensively. For instance, Michigan, John Beilein's offense is an awesome, immaculately spaced offense. And I think it leads to some prospects ending up, you know, kind of being overrated a little bit just because they're actually playing in a pro-style scheme that gives them driving lanes and gives them open shots, whereas some other schemes don't necessarily derive that value from the player.
Looking over at the right side of the bracket a little bit here, too. We've been on the left a lot. What should folks do with the SEC title game? Because Auburn beat the hell out of Tennessee, and Tennessee's a 2-spot, Auburn's a 5. Should they lift the Vols, or fade the Vols, rather, or lift Auburn more?
Well, the only thing that kind of scares me for Tennessee, because I actually really like this Tennessee team, but you know, they got matched up with Cincinnati in Columbus, Ohio, in the second round, potentially. That is a matchup that would scare me if I was Tennessee. Now, I know that you know Tennessee is not that far from Cincinnati or from Columbus. They will probably travel up there, but it is like an hour and a half drive from Cincinnati. That place is going to be maybe not quite a home game for Cincinnati, but it's going to be a high-level atmosphere for Cincinnati, I think, where more fans will be rooting for Cincinnati. So I think that's kind of a tough it's a tough situation for Tennessee. I actually really like the Vols. I think they're a great team, but I don't know. Part of me is kind of getting stuck there with that Cincinnati at home game vibe. And then in Auburn's case, you know, Auburn gets a really tough New Mexico State team. They play like 13 dudes every single night. It's crazy. Chris Jans is an unbelievable coach. They've won 30 games this season. They're a really, really good offensive team who can knock down threes and who gets great looks inside the arc because of their ability to space the floor. So I do think Auburn is kind of on alert here for upset. I have not really been a huge fan of what I've seen from them throughout the whole season, for the most part because I just think they have small guards, and some of their bigs just aren't really all that good. Like Austin Wiley, I don't think is very good. And it leads them to playing undersized like a mid-major does a lot of the time.
People love that 5-12 upset, and I haven't seen the updated numbers to if the metrics actually tell us it continues to be more likely, but I've seen people picking Oregon over Wisconsin. We were mentioning Murray State, mm-hmm. Marquette, that some of these things. Do we know, and do you know maybe just sort of trying to intuit why the 5-12 lends itself to upsets? Is it because that's where you might get an upstart conference champion on the 12 line against a bigger school that might have underachieved on the 5? I'm sure there's good reason for it, but it does seem like it happens often.
Yeah, so the reason why I think it happens more often is that it just often ends up being the cut line between the at-large teams and the conference champion, you know, guaranteed conference tournament winners, like you said. Those teams are often underrated in large part because of the schedule that they play. They wouldn't really be considered for an at-large berth because, you know, quote-unquote, they don't have the wins that you need to be considered for an at-large berth, right? So, like, Murray State this season, I think, has beaten, you know, Belmont and zero other top 50 teams this season. So if they didn't win their conference tournament, they were not getting in as an at-large in all likelihood. But, you know, if you watch Murray State, you can see a circumstance where they have Ja Morant. They have other athletic dudes. They have a guy that tried to throw down a 360 alley-oop like with 4 minutes left in the game of a tight game against Belmont. These guys can fly. There's an easy way to believe that they can beat a lot of really, really good teams, I think. And that's why I think that you see that. It's the difference between resume and actual talent, and that tends to be the breaking point for where that kind of disconnect occurs.
Sam, lots of great information. We appreciate it, man. Thank you.
Yep, anytime, guys.
That is Sam Vecenie of The Athletic. And what I need from you, Connor McKnight, is a number.
7.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Caller 7 of the contest line, 312-591-6700. Wins a pair of tickets to the Cubs season preview party with Matt Spiegel and Pat Hughes on March 24th at the Blue Cross Blue Shield Performance Stage, courtesy of the Illinois Lottery's new Lucky Sevens instant ticket. Must be 18 or older to play. Keep listening, too, because you still have an opportunity when you hear the cue to call to be caller 6 to the contest line. The contest line.
Contest line.
And that way you might get yourself a pair of Cubs season tickets once you qualify.
We have seen some innovation across an ocean. Sure, it's a baseball product that we've seen for many, many, many years, and things are going to open up Wednesday in the wee hours, but there was something pretty damn cool that I saw that could be headed toward your television in the near future. We'll get to it next. It's Bernstein and McKnight, 670 The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
You teased us with baseball things.
We got a couple of things shaking, Dan, in Major League Baseball. Some innovations, some things that could hit your broadcast perhaps this coming season, maybe next. Picture this, if you will, and if you've been on the MLB Instagram page or Twitter profile lately, you've probably seen it. A camera attached somewhere to the home plate umpire's face mask so that when a two-seamer comes into Mitch Haniger of the Seattle Mariners, and it maybe just doesn't shift as much. Maybe it stays right about belt high.
I just retweeted it.
And old Mitchy Mitch is ready to rock on this thing. You watch the home run fly out of the ballpark, whether he's in Tokyo or on the West Coast or playing against the Yankees or whatever. It is, if you haven't seen the video, Dan just retweeted it. We'll retweet it from the show account too, Bernstein_MCK. As much as I bring it up, because as much as you and I have kind of railed against a few of the new rules that Major League Baseball is throwing in, whether it's the three-batter minimum or, you know, fewer mound visits or all this kind of stuff that'll happen this year or next year, depending on how the negotiations between the union and the league go, what I have been adamant about is that the way you're going to get more and younger viewers to your game is not through cutting 7 minutes off a regular season broadcast. While it could help, it's not going to reshape the demographics of your fan base. It won't. It just won't. Doing stuff like this, cool new camera angles, broadcast innovation, bringing players closer to fans and giving a little bit more access to a game that has been a little stodgy over the last 25 years or so since the strike, that's a good way to do it. This is a step in the right direction. If you're going to show that kind of angle, because it was also shows, and the particular video that Haniger takes deep, the particular pitch, rather, that he takes deep, that's a meatball. That's a nothing pitch. It's the old cement mixer on the way up.
Yeah, who were we watching a talking stick that was throwing?
Greg Holland.
Yes.
Greg Holland, who was throwing the old spinner that afternoon. No, this was not a difficult pitch to hit, but this camera angle, it's pretty cool. I saw Jay retweeted earlier this morning. You could show it in a wipeout pitch or a home run. Like, there's benefit to it. There's like added points to a broadcast regardless of the outcome of the particular pitch, because you see something that is so, it's such a new broadcast angle. You're seeing it from the scout seats. That's
it reminds
really where you've seen
me
it from.
Of the NFL's Madden angle that I'm just completely there for.
It's the dangling sky cam, right? That one?
Yes. Where you watch the play develop. It's like the teaching film angle. If you want to see launch angle.
Yeah.
If you want to see swing plane. If you want to see from a pitcher's perspective also, when a pitcher talks about, I need to see a guy's swing shape to know where I'm going to place a ball. All the stuff we talked to Kyle Hendricks about. The more you can try to make that real and make it manifest so it's not just words, that's great. It's great for people who aren't necessarily married to things looking and feeling the way they always have. The average age of the baseball fan that watches games on TV is 57.
That's probably too old.
The average age is
I'm not saying being 57 is too old. I'm just saying that that's probably too old from the front office's perspective.
It is too old from a baseball perspective. You have to get young guys on your television.
You may not remember this, but a big segment of baseball Twitter lit up last season. It was the season prior when Rob Friedman's Twitter handle was taken down. Rob Friedman is at Pitching Ninja on Twitter. He's the guy who does all the awesome GIFs of wipeout pitches, of Syndergaard stuff. He has 111,000 followers, and he's retweeted by like every single beat writer who sees something cool from a pitcher that they cover, and then that stuff gets out to a particular fan base. MLB stopped him from posting the GIFs that he was posting because of, I don't know, some ridiculous archaic broadcast rules and whatever. But what they didn't realize was that he's helping more than he's hurting. These types of Twitter accounts and these types of cool video help more than they hurt this league. So getting it out there in front of everyone, I think is a much better way to market your product than not.
The bottom of the hour is brought to you by Northwestern Football. Don't miss your chance to watch Big Ten football at Ryan Field this fall as the Big Ten West champion Northwestern Wildcats host Ohio State, Iowa, and more. Season tickets on sale now at nusports.com. I am open to any of it and all of it.
Not all innovation is great, though. I mean, your heart might be in the right place, and you might head down the way of like advanced technology and trying to put it in the game and make it work. I think we may have a case of this as well from Nationals camp today. Follow Jesse Doherty, who's a beat writer for them for MLB.com. Washington Post, rather. Used to be MLB.com. He tweets this, and I don't have any more. I can't elucidate this for you. I can't make this any more clear. I just have three sentences. MLB is at Nationals camp today, workshopping a new communication device for pitchers and catchers. It would allow catchers to type a pitch call with location into a watch that is connected to a watch the pitcher is wearing on the mound.
No.
An effort to eliminate sign stealing.
Wait a second.
What?
All you're going to do is have that signal intercepted easily.
It's going to be hacked immediately. It's going to be hacked
I guarantee you it's already been hacked.
Doherty probably hacked it while he was watching it happen.
Yeah, by like a six-year-old. That beta test was hacked.
And it's already gone.
The Russians have.
Let's circle back on this. Yeah, well, they're going to hack the technology. Circle back on this. Remember Major League Baseball, like 3 weeks ago? When did you do the story? It was like 3 weeks ago. Before we left for spring training, they had the new rules on who has to watch the video guy who's watching the game on sign stealing. They are breaking this down. They are, if not worried, then just decidedly draconian on this whole sign stealing thing. They want it out of the game. This is a convoluted, seemingly from a distance, a convoluted piece of technology thrown into the game to combat an issue that MLB clearly thinks is a big effing deal. I mean, you don't just introduce.
You don't invest in that.
Brand new types of technology, and they're workshopping it. It doesn't feel like it's anywhere close or whatever. But all of their efforts in rules changes, in shortening commercial breaks, all that stuff, is to shorten the game just a little bit. Rob Manfred wants to take this down another 10 minutes per game. Yes, that is his goal. That is baseball's stated goal here, almost more than anything else. Perhaps sometimes even to the detriment of the game. I mean, if you're going to ban shifts, we're not headed there yet, but we might be. But you're interested enough in introducing a piece of technology where a guy has to type a thing on a watch, and then another guy has to read that thing on a... You're telling me that's going to speed the game up?
Think about this.
It'd take an hour and a half.
How about a base runner waiting for the catcher to drop his eyes so he can type on his watch?
And take it off?
Yes.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
Right?
Watch that.
Well, he caught him typing.
He's looking down. Clearly, autocorrect had gotten him here, and that's why we've got Billy Hamilton down in third instead of second.
My kids make fun of me because you text so slow.
Well, that's...
You text so slow.
First of all, you do, but it happened. Like, those texts, the watch is going to be... It's going to be like reading Mitch's emails. It's going to be like, Sliffer off to the left, down in, thanks.
Right.
T-Y-T-Y. Right.
Sliffer to the lorf.
T-Y-Y-T.
It's not going to mean anything. They're going to be so... I'm sure it'll be like... A bunch of auto chosen, you know, like your predictive text thing you have that turned on your iPhone.
Yeah.
You do the game where you start typing a thing and then you let predictive text fill out the rest of the, and you end up with something like, I kill robots or something, you know, whatever.
I must kill
the
queen.
The best is if you start, did this the other day, you start a sentence with autocorrect and then just let it fill out. Autocorrect is the only three options you'll get is great, awesome, or best. That's all it'll give you.
Uh-oh.
Because they're like Bradley with their autocorrect. They can't let criticism
promoting
solve.
The brand
can't
the
happen.
Autocorrect. The segment is brought to you by Patrick Cadillac.
We're not going
to
mention Mitch's text from yesterday about
forgot about that.
Hold on. You have it?
Yeah.
All right.
A picture from the press box at Sloan with our scorehouse itinerary. And the note from Mitch says, stop by the press box at Sloan in the boob we used. Memories of Scorehouse left behind. Hello to all. Great memories. #nuts anyone. I'm not sure which boob we used, but I don't remember that.
We all used it, though.
Oh, get you every suspended, though. You got to be very, very careful with such things. Yeah, I saw that. I was on the golf course when I got it. I looked, the phone buzzed, and I check like every couple of holes just in case my wife's. And I look, and I'm like, I'm not getting involved in this because I knew it was absolutely ridiculous. So I just sort of let that one go. And I realized you were just making fun of a Mitch text.
No, absolutely. That's all that was.
Something else that when you're talking about learning to watch things in certain ways and look at, and how young people watch things.
Yeah. Okay.
I watched a lot of Fortnite this weekend.
Did you? Don't tell Carlos Santana that.
Well, Jeff Passan's got this story.
Carlos
here.
Is not going to be happy with
and, you. And we talked before about video game spectating and what the future is. Do people want to watch on Twitch? And I said one of my favorite things, because my recumbent bike in the basement faces the television on which my son plays Fortnite with his friends.
Sure.
And, he's got his earbuds in, and all they do is complain.
Does he have friends over to play?
No. It's all virtual.
It's all, okay.
It's all virtual. Sometimes there'll be, he'll have his phone out, and you'll hear somebody who's on the phone.
He'll have a FaceTime
or something
going.
Somebody's playing on mobile and another person. All these conversations occurring. But I don't know if you have a Fortnite player in your house. It's the amount of complaining. Like, you can't just lose because a guy kicked your ass or sniped you. It's always, I was glitching.
Right.
Or I did 149 damage, or I'm lagging.
I'm lagging.
Yeah. It's just the complaints. It's like, can't you just lose a game? So I just sit there and laugh. And one of my favorite things would be to heckle him when he's bad. He's actually gotten good. He and his friends, when they play duos, have really gotten in. Like, they're consistently top five and frequently down to the final two, and finally got the building down, working together, understanding who needs what, give this to me, get the guy in the storm, using the storm as a weapon, and it gotten very clever at it. And once you learn to build and find high ground and all this stuff, I've really enjoyed it. And it's, and I'm starting to have a sensibility for being open to new and different things in the way I see stuff now. Because now, I'm used to it. It doesn't look all that fast to me anymore, and it doesn't look weird to me anymore. When they're toggling between the map
and
the treasure map
and
option screens, I've just started to bake it in a little bit.
Sure. Yeah, where he's headed. You understand what the game flow is.
Yep.
For what it's worth, it's not just your boy and his friends that are complaining here. That has been going on since time immemorial in multiplayer. Like, if it was GoldenEye, it was you were screen watching and you're not allowed to screen watch, or maybe you are, or maybe you were odd job or something like that. That's illegal. I mean, people have been in these games where it's like the first person shooters, people have been bitching about nonsense.
So predictable. I was
since
lagging.
It started.
I hit him. My scope was right on him.
Oh, what the
How
hell?
Did I not hit him?
No, it's the
How did he get me before I got him?
It's a time on tradition of gamers. Just to yell and scream
you're
about things that are
babies?
Yeah, that's why we're playing these games instead of outside doing literally anything else.
You mentioned Fortnite and MLB. Jeff Passan
has
a spectacular story about something that happened to the Phillies last year in this regard.
I was confused as to why the Phillies made this trade a couple of months ago. I am no longer confused.
Now, there's three great lead paragraphs here. We'll get to this. Then we've got a full weekend's worth of midway catching up to do at the top of the hour. Bernstein and McKnight, keep it here on The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
I saw one comment on this Jeff Passan story where it flew by in my timeline, but it was the wife of a sports writer who responded by saying, "Carlos Santana is my spirit animal." Here's the story. This is our guy Jeff Passan, who we had the pleasure of hanging out with for a little bit.
Yeah, it's good to run into him.
At Talking Stick. When the Philadelphia Phillies lost their ninth consecutive game toward the end of last September, veteran first baseman Carlos Santana felt like he needed to send a message to his teammates, who he said spent portions of the game against the Atlanta Braves playing video games in the clubhouse.
Not a good look.
Santana grabbed a bat, retreated to the room at Citizens Bank Park where the gaming took place, and smashed the TV to ensure there would be no more Fortnite the final 2 days of the season. "I see a couple players. I don't want to say names. They play video games during the game," Santana said. we come and lose too many games. I felt like they weren't worried about it, weren't respecting their teammates or coaches or the staff or the front office. It's not my personality, but I'm angry because I want to make it good. As the Phillies transition to a new era, led by their blockbuster signing of Bryce Harper, along with a trade for star catcher JT Realmuto and a handful of other big offseason transactions. They do so coming off a topsy-turvy season in which they dropped from first place in the NL East on August 12th to below 500 by the end of the year. They acknowledge that excessive Fortnite games led to the Santana incident September 28th, and they've spent the offseason not just overhauling what was the youngest roster in baseball, but reimagining a clubhouse dynamic that numerous people in the organization believe had grown problematic.
Carlos Santana was traded on December 3rd by the Phillies to the Mariners for Juan Nicasio, James Pazos, and Gene Segura. J.P. Crawford went to the M's as well. Yeah, it kind of makes sense, right? You're heading out. The only thing, though,
can't play Fortnite during the game.
During is bad.
During is bad.
You're not supposed to be doing it during
now,
the game.
Before is kind of cool, like when the Brewers patched it in through their giant
put
video
it on the big
board,
screen.
That was cool.
That was kind of cool. And remember, we had an issue with David Price perhaps playing too much Fortnite and aggravating a forearm injury. He probably didn't, but he was accused of it just last season, I think, right? 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. Too much Fortnite for him. I find it funny, though, that Carlos Santana is now the emblem of those who want to own the millenniums, right? The millennials, they're all in on this. Want to own the millenniums, you have to. Carlos Santana was born in 1986. He is younger than I am. He's 32 years. He is a millennial fighting against the millenniums in a battle that will rage on as the storm shrinks. It's he's great.
This is from Rudy.
Millenniums.
Who says, I love that Carlos Santana story. I'm totally not that guy. But if I came into the clubhouse during a game and teammates are playing video games, I am smashing everything and yelling, get off my lawn.
That is pretty sacred. The during the game thing. I mean, that's where you get all kinds. Like, Ken Griffey got yelled at for napping during games.
He was a Hall of Famer. He wasn't really yelled at.
You're right. He wasn't yelled at. He was publicly reprimanded. He was slapped on the wrist.
Do you remember the story?
A little bit.
The story is he was sleeping, and they said, you know, you might want to warm up. And he pointed to the logo on his arm.
The swingman
like
on his shoe, I think,
he
or something.
The swingman is like, that guy knows what he's doing. Something like that.
I went into what game I was covering is a White Sox game. He was still on the Mariners. He was back on the Mariners. Griffey was. And I was going to cover for the score. And I missed the Griffey thing here with the White Sox. I don't think I was working at the time. So I was like, all right, Mitch, I'll go cover the game. That's great. Sounds good. I bailed on all of my responsibilities to go camp out in the Mariners locker room and talk to Griffey because I knew he was only going to talk, you know, the one time. And I knew Gonzo and other people were going to go over and talk to him after they had covered him a little bit here. And he was really nice and he talked or whatever. I'm sitting there in front of Griffey. I mean, this was one of those early moments, sports reporter sees guy who he worshiped and wanted. Like, I was pretending to be Griffey in the backyard and stuff. So we're talking and, you know, everybody's asking questions. I ask him some stupid, inane question like I always do about like hitting for power or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And Griffey clearly realizes like, okay, this will be the last question and I'm going to go out and take the little amount of BP that I need. He looks at me, smiles, grabs the bat out of the bat rack, kind of turns so as to, you know, let me make sure that I could see everything. And he goes, you can't go yard, kid, without backyard. Slaps his ass and then walks out to go take BP.
That's awesome.
It was like the best thing I've ever
seen.
That's
like
laughed.
Out of a,
it,
you wouldn't
I laughed
put that in a
so
movie.
Hard. It was so great.
You would not put that in a movie.
It was so, so great. Gonzo, the whole thing, it was like one of the best moments of my first 5 years of the score. It was amazing.
I love those little locker room, the pregame locker room things that you never forget.
Yeah, without backyard.
In the sports where you're allowed to be in the locker room pregame, my favorite is still a very young Allen Iverson. This is right when they got down to the scary long shorts. Remember the NBA was cracking on the length of shorts?
This
is when David Stern was just on the prowl. This is when they were...
That's where the dress code came in for travel, right?
Yeah, and this is when they were... And for the bench, and when they were erasing... They were airbrushing Iverson's tattoos on the cover of Hoop magazine
because
he couldn't have these thuggish tattoos.
How dare he?
The cornrows, and they were measuring shorts. So there, Iverson is standing there in these long-ass shorts, right? And he's by his locker, and I said to him, Allen, there's no way that those are going to come in to, under the limit. He's like, no, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to roll my it was like talking to my kid. He's got his waistband. He's like, he's like, no. He's like, I can go like this. With I'm going to go out for warm-ups, and I pull the waistband. And flips over the waistband. Goes go like this.
Yeah.
And then I get my jersey like this. And then they come and measure him. And then afterward, that's when I can drop them down where they got to be. So I look over. And the look on the face of like a 37-year-old Rick Mahorn, whatever it was, Rick Mahorn sitting there with his little, he's reading something. He's got his styrofoam cup of coffee. He smells just like a bomb of Flexol. And he looks at Iverson, and he looks at me, and he just gives me like this half shrug, like, I don't know what I'm talking about. Whatever.
Mahorn takes 9 minutes to get up off his chair.
I know, it was so great. I literally looked at him, I was like, don't ask me, whatever. You figure him out.
It was the anniversary of Iverson crossing up Michael Jordan at the top of the key, like last week or the week before, something like that. So that led me into, you know, kind of the YouTube spiral of watching Iverson highlights. And you watch.
Oh, man. Come on.
You watch the jerseys of some of these, like the giant baggy shorts and the huge, like they weren't tank. I don't know what you call them, like big tank tops, like the Cincinnati Reds BP jerseys, but they don't have sleeves. They're
like
cutoffs.
Yeah,
they're like a t-shirt that got the sleeves cut off. Yeah. But just that, it looked so out of place. And then you see a guy like Kyle Korver, who gets drafted onto that team, like who's still there and around and playing. I don't know whether I'm more like kind of taken aback by the giant shorts that existed when I was a kid watching the NBA, or now watching more college. Like you watch the Michigan Wolverines, like this last weekend, they're wearing short shorts.
And leggings.
Michigan is wearing short shorts.
Right.
And some of them even have, some of the guys will wear the leggings, yeah, down like past the knee, something like that, like the spandex leggings. But some even have just the athletic shorts, the compression shorts that extend out from under the shorts.
Mm-hmm.
Because the regular shorts are so short.
That was the look in the early 90s, were the compression shorts that you could see outside of short. And then like in the mid 90s, it got messed up.
No, and then everything went super long and super baggy. And then wasn't there a run to, who was it that he'd gotten banged up a couple of times and dropped to the floor? Tall dude. Maybe it was Durant. He started wearing the spandex with the like a flak jacket in it. It had like compression.
Oh, hex pants.
Yeah.
Hex pants. I actually have a set of hex pants.
He started wearing some of those around the ribs and around the hips and stuff.
D-Wade and D-Rose.
Have
you ever worn hex pads?
I have like a pair of sliding shorts that have them, but I don't think they're actual hex pads.
The company sent them to me when we talked about them in the air years ago. I have them hanging in the closet. You feel invincible in those things.
Like you could take a fastball off the elbow invincible, or you could just take it down the lane invincible.
I am surprised more hockey players don't avail themselves of hex pads. And maybe some of them do, but I mean,
you just have to take a puck to
the ribs. No, you feel pretty invincible in those things. They're very cleverly designed. The top of the hour is brought to you by Northwestern Football. Spring football is underway. Join Coach Fitz and the Cats this fall at Ryan Field. Matchups include Ohio State and Iowa. Season tickets on sale now at nusports.com.
The Midday Midway is up next. I got a story about a terracotta breakdown and a tax refund that is not going to go your way.
I want to sing Terracotta Breakdown to the tune of Led Zeppelin's Communication Breakdown.
Thank you.
But I'm not going to. I have an attempted heist at not just a casino, but a casino known for a famous fictional heist. I have a new invasive species that is making its way into
That's
the
good.
Southeast.
We're running out of those.
And I have a terrifying story reminiscent of something from a Stephen King film.
The Midday Midway is next on Bernstein and McKnight, 670 The Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.